This is the Land and Legacy Podcast, brought to you by Whitetail Properties Real Estate. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye. This is your weekly resource for habitat management, wildlife management, and recreational real estate. We hope you guys enjoy the show.
Hey guys, welcome back. Land and Legacy Podcast, Adam here. This is a podcast with Matt and I as we interview Ryan DeSantis of Oklahoma State Extension. This is a podcast that is going to cover a lot of things, forestry management. But most importantly, we're going to dive into topics that we have never discussed on this podcast. And, you know, we've done a lot of podcasts over the course of launching this. So we're going to cover some stuff that is a very hot topic, hot button topic in society today. And we're going to discuss how we as landowners and hunters can convey our messaging to the general public in a way that makes us better than just deer killers. So this is a podcast you don't want to miss out if you're looking at managing your forest, log your farm, improve your health of your forest, and ultimately improve the habitat on your farm. So without further ado, we're going to jump right in.
All right, guys, welcome back. We're going to jump right into this podcast. We have Ryan DeSantis from Oklahoma State University. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We jumped in so fast, as I was saying, I was like, oop, I don't know. I think I got it correct, but tell us a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, so I'm a new faculty member at Oklahoma State. Been here about 4 months now. I got my PhD here in the Natural Resource Ecology and Management Department about 12 years ago. And I've worked in Minnesota with the Forest Service out west for University of California Cooperative Extension. Worked for the state of Wyoming for several years. And then most recently, I was a instructor of forestry in northern Minnesota. So I've been kind of done several different things in a lot of different places, learned a lot about different forest ecosystems around the U.S.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think what interests me in your travels and your job, there's different cultures and probably different emphasis on forestry management and ecology with, you know, you mentioned Wyoming and Minnesota and then California and the messaging. I'm sure working with the general public or the public outreach and the education varied. And so that's going to be kind of a strong emphasis on what we're going to discuss on this podcast. So when you were doing, I to give the listeners an understanding of where this podcast came from, there was a post. Matt, why don't you explain it? You're the one who kind of ran this down.
Yeah, there's a post that Oklahoma State had done. And if you guys don't follow them on social media, definitely need to. They have a great natural resource department that puts out a lot of educational content. And a post caught my eye about fire scars and fire ecology. I believe that was out of New Mexico, and sent a message regarding the frequency of fire on the landscape and whatnot. They were able to message us back and kind of started the podcast idea of, hey, there's something more here. And we've kind of rabbit trailed it into the conversation we're going to go today. But essentially, fire ecology and scars left on residual trees kind of got this thing started. And I know, Ryan, too, that's where your PhD work or some of your graduate work came from, is doing that specifically in Oklahoma, correct?
Right. And that was mostly in oak forests. So a lot of post oak, blackjack oak. I definitely heavily involved in research during my PhD years. So now I'm 30% extension, 70% teaching. So talking to you guys and interfacing with landowners and managers of different agencies is, you know, should be at least a third of my emphasis for my position. Yep.
Very cool. Well, I know that we're going to definitely want to talk about that fire ecology from that research that you did, but for another podcast, because fire is such a prevalent thing that we're promoting from the wildlife side of things. But I think to really stay on track for today's podcast, we're going to really talk about and want you to discuss the benefits of a healthy forest and what a healthy forest system does look like, because there's a lot of misunderstandings regarding that term forest and active management and what that can and should entail. That might be a good launching point, I think, for the conversation. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, for sure. I think, let's just start with the basic terms or a basic question and just ask Ryan, what would be your, based on your research, what would be your definition of a healthy forest? And let's just use an example of a Midwestern forest that's oak hickory.
Yeah, that's really been a changing target through time too, depending on who you ask and whether you ask them in the 1970s or you ask them in 2022, you probably get a different answer. I think
Yeah.
now we tend to focus on resiliency. We used to focus on HRV, historical range of variation. So we used to think, well, we should return things to pre-European times or back to when Native Americans used fire or, other techniques. Now it's more about how can we alter forest landscapes or keep managing them so that they're set up for success in the future. And I think that's what I like to focus on. I think that's a probably a little bit wiser way to manage in an oak hickory forest or more cross timbers forest type like we have in a lot of Oklahoma. Really forests that have adapted with fire over time. So we know we've got to have fire in the landscape somehow. Definitely for regeneration with oak and whatever we can do to create a more resilient forest in the future, whether it's insects, diseases, trying to create a forest that can withstand higher intensity fires or more drought. That might be changing species, that might be different forest structure. Whatever we can do to try to help a forest out to be able to get through some of those disturbances in the future, I think that's probably the wise way to manage at this point.
So, you brought up the past and past ideas, and I think for me, one thing that we've talked about in the on our podcast a lot has been as we move forward and everyone being aware, and we'll try to avoid political, but let's just say the changing climate or the change of the landscape, and we know that there's more carbon in the air, and I would assume that that's basically a big problem. But I think one of the basis that I tend to go off of, or I tend to think back on, is people used to have the belief that planting trees was the way we were going to stop, and that was good for the environment. But at the same time, we had trees, forests that were overstocked, too many trees, they were unhealthy, they were prone for disease and pests and everything like that. So, what has been just in general shifting? Have you noticed that shift? I'm sure from the academia, but also public. What is part of your approach? That's where this podcast is trying to help reach the landowner to understand that and the importance of that and how we can move forward for healthier forests.
You brought up something that's almost a soapbox issue for me. It's so yeah, we can talk about planting trees all day, but what's going to happen to those trees in the future? I lived in Cheyenne, Wyoming for a few years, and they had a really great program where they had funding to plant a tree or a couple trees in your yard. Well, they scaled it down so they had fewer trees per customer and fewer customers. They used more of their money for the upkeep of the trees over the next 2 years. So that city is basically high desert, gets about 10 inches of precipitation per year. So they decided, you know, we're going to set up, you know, a watering bag or structure to keep those trees alive for the next 2 years. So it's obviously more than just putting a tree in the ground. It's picking the right tree species, the right growing medium, putting it in the right place, and then actually taking care of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's slowly becoming more common knowledge. Perhaps I've seen more things like that where people are aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly need more trees worldwide, but we need to put them in the right places. We need to focus on the right tree species in the right environment. So there's certainly places like, you know, in the Amazon where we're just losing trees, you know, too quickly. Things are, you know, becoming a monoculture of something else that perhaps is not native.
Yeah.
And we're losing biomass worldwide. There's no question about it. But if we're talking about in the US, we have more trees now than we did, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And we know that in most states, forestry is done sustainably. We know that, for example, for a typical Christmas tree farm, we plant two or three trees per every tree we harvest typically, right? So it's not that we're going out and stripping the land of every last tree out there. We've done that before. We basically learned from some of those mistakes in the past. And I'd say now forestry is done certainly so people can make money, but there's also people understand that in order to have a sustainable business, they need to have a sustainable forest as well. So I'd say, you know, we certainly know that we can sequester carbon, but we also know we're going to become a carbon source and no longer a carbon sink if we plant too many trees that are the wrong species in the wrong place. So I think we've kind of wised up over the past several decades.
Yeah, that's, to me, there was two, I think we did a podcast and we talked about some of the biggest things that we can look back on and hopefully learn from. And one of them was the Smokey the Bear campaign, and it caused this fear of fire and all fire was bad. And it was like, whoa, we got to pump the brakes and we got to understand that not all fire is bad, but wildfires are our problem. But, and the same thing with planting trees and, you know, just planting, even as far as, you know, a cereal company a couple years ago did a campaign for the bees, and they just threw a bunch of wildflowers in a packet, and they weren't even native to half the country. And you were just throwing wildflower seeds all over, and it was just like a horrible problem. So it's awesome to hear that people are starting to wise up to trying to identify native trees for their region and then planting those. As far as you said, let's just talk about a forest from a business, because you kind of touched on that, but sustainable forest. In your position, what would a landowner, private landowner in the Midwest, where there's an active timber market, where you can, there's mills close, what would a sustainable forest in setting your farm up for future harvest, not just the current harvest, but future harvest, look like? How would you go about managing that?
Yeah, good question. I hate to answer with "it depends," but
that's that, they're used to that. Our audience is very used to that.
We love that answer.
And you know, it depends on one, you know, what type of forest are we talking about. So if you're further south in southeastern Oklahoma or Arkansas and you're growing, let's say, loblolly pine,
yeah,
then that's going to look a lot different. You know, that sustainable forest might be harvested every 20 to 30 years because it grows so fast, and you can get a pretty valuable product in 30 or 40 years. If it's an oak forest on marginal land that's marginal for growing trees, let's say you're in central Oklahoma, now you're talking about something that's, you know, how do we make this work economically, period? Probably we don't. If the focus is on a sustainable forest, then we do the management and maybe we incur a loss. But that probably opens up a lot wider discussion on what kind of resources do we want to get from our forest. Are we going to manage for hunting? Are we going to manage for carbon? then we probably could try to come close to breaking even with our marginal oak forest.
Yeah.
If it's, you know, further northeast from me in Missouri or, you know, up into the central Midwest, then probably a lot more hardwoods we're managing for. In that case, unlike our loblolly pine, maybe we're managing on a little bit more uneven age system, meaning, you know, we take a few trees here and there each year, but we're not cutting every last stem out there.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, I mean, this probably gets more into forestry and forest ecology, but, you know, again, depending on the species, if it's a pine, then typically it's going to be growing on an even age system where we're going to go in and clear cut, take pretty much every stem, replant, yeah, grow it 30 years, do it all over again. So kind of depends on, you know, what's the tree species, where are we geographically, and what are the desired outcomes? Do we want to get lots of wood products, or are we open to all these alternative forest products like maybe hunting leases or maybe, you know, forest health improvement, that kind of thing?
This is one of my favorite questions to ask guests. So I'm going to say, you just inherited, you had a long lost uncle, and he left you 250 acres in central Missouri that is a mix of oak, hickory, a few small openings, but it's pretty well closed canopy hardwoods. And you go in and you now get to do your goals. And I'm going to give you those goals, so I'm sorry. But your goals are, you're trying to produce some income, create a healthier forest, a diversified forest, and you're interested in wildlife. What would be your steps in doing that? What would be a long-term strategy for you?
So no softwoods, no shortleaf pine, no...
No shortleaf, but there are the softwoods. There are some flowering dogwoods and different, you know, sassafras. And there's some, let's see. I'm trying to think of some other. There's a little bit of maple, but not much. It's pretty much a oak hickory forest.
In multiple age classes, not the same throughout,
kind of, but if you look at Overstory, it's oak hickory. I'm just going to describe my farm for him, Matt, so we can. Oak hickory is the Overstory. The Midstory's got a little bit of white oak, but it's starting to be dominated by flowering dogwood and some other softwood trees, sassafras, and then the Understory is almost completely sassafras and flowering dogwood, very little oak region.
So that description in this conversation is almost a good way to kind of engage landowners on what their land looks like and what they want to do, what's possible in the future too. I'd say if it was me and given my interests, I mean, you know, I'd be interested in maybe doing some bow hunting, trying to improve the stand for forest health and for wildlife diversity. Maybe improve it for, let's say, more deer or better deer habitat, better diverse animal habitat. Not real sure if you're growing oaks that are valuable enough that we can actually send off to barrel and stave industry. But if you've got white oaks, if you got Quercus alba, not post oak. But if there's any white oak that's of decent quality, then potentially we have a pretty high value forest product there.
Yep.
And, you know, I think if we're going to do anything, we need to find some value in the products we're going to get from those trees. We don't have to get rich off of it, but if we can at least fund the management we're going to do, then that would be great. So
yep.
I'd probably be interested in trying to increase our oak recruitment.
Yep.
Sounds like there's some oak that's probably not going to grow so well in the midstory or understory. Maybe time to do some thinning, maybe mm-hmm. do some small patch selection cuts. And I'm a big fan of diversity. I think, you know, going back to forest health and resiliency, if you've got all the same thing, and you've got, you know, a host of different forest health threats, even if they're native, you're going to run into problems every few decades. So even, you know, out west, the native species is ponderosa pine. The native threat is mountain pine beetle. Well, we know every 50 to 100 years, we're going to run into a big problem again. In that case, that's native, you know, that's going to happen. But if we're talking about central Missouri, the more we can diversify so we don't create those recurring problems and we can set things up for the long run for a healthier forest, the more the better. So I'd do some thinning, some patch cuts, some selection cutting. I'd try to focus on promoting oak. So try to get more light into that forest, essentially. Mm-hmm. Maybe make some trails, some shooting alleys if you're going to put in places for bow hunting. I'd try to focus on oak in general. So maybe we put some fire on the ground, maybe some dormant season prescribed fire, and pair that with thinning, and we might be on our way.
I think it's funny, Adam, as Ryan's been talking about this, may use different terms or may come at this from a perspective of producing forestry type products. But in the scenario that he just laid out, this is what we encounter a lot, right? This is what a lot of landowners, recreational landowners, have in the Midwest. And we say Midwest, but really we're talking Tennessee, we're talking Kentucky. You get into some other tree varieties, but generally speaking, that encompasses a lot of people who are listening to this podcast. But what it also does from a terminology standpoint is we talk about bedding thickets, we talk about clear cuts, we talk about TSI and thinning and following up with prescribed fire, adding the value of sunlight into the forest floor. What that does from a regeneration standpoint, we're talking the same game is what I'm trying to say. And so people, whether you want to come at it from a wildlife standpoint or a combination of that and forestry, we're talking the same type of techniques that should be used on your property. So there's multiple professionals saying the same thing, probably should do it, right? Like that's kind of a call to action. Like this is the right prescriptions generally for what a lot of people are dealing with and based on their goals should be doing.
So that opens the door for my next question, Ryan, and saying, okay, you're rolling in, you're going to be on that 250 acres. You're going to start cutting some trees, but whoa, whoa, whoa. The neighbors in the area, they see you as the new guy that just inherited this land, and you're going in and logging it and doing some logging, and they see it as you're just a money hungry. You're going to take the money and then you're going to sell the place. How would you go about, and let's say one of the landowners, the neighboring landowners, is from a region of the United States that is not familiar with active timber management, but they're very environmental, very strong in trying to create a landscape that is healthy for future generations. Let's just say they rolled out of LA, California, and for some reason they're your neighbor in central Missouri. Somehow that happened. How do you go about messaging and trying to educate them on the fact that you cutting trees is good for the environment?
If it's somebody from California, that almost makes it too easy because the fire situation makes it easy to draw a parallel there. I grew up in New Hampshire and Maine and spent plenty of time in Vermont. Still have plenty of friends, plenty of acquaintances that we probably disagree on forest management because they stayed stuck in that forest advocacy role, but they haven't really continued to look outside of their own perspective and learn a little bit more about forest management and forest ecology. I think this conversation in a place like California is developing more rapidly out of necessity. You've got so many people that are surrounded by fuel as in trees, whether they're live standing or dead on the ground. And out of necessity, people have to do something about it. So
yeah,
if it's somebody from California, there's an easy parallel there to make, which is now Missouri doesn't have that same fire issue quite like in California. But take a place like Branson. You know, if we compare that to so there was a place in Eastern Tennessee, I'm drawing a blank, but in the Smokies, there was a fire.
Gatlinburg.
So yeah. We've got a, you know, in Oklahoma, we've got, you know, Broken Bow Lake in that area, Hochatown.
Yep.
That's kind of our equivalent. Maybe in Missouri, that's a place like Branson. And you've got a place where there are so many people. You're surrounded by so many fuels and forests that are mostly unmanaged. And the equivalent of that is a place like California, where of course fire has been part of that landscape and forest ecology for much longer, but that doesn't mean it's also not an important part in a place like Missouri. In Missouri, you know, you've got plenty of ecosystems that have evolved with fire as well. So, whether it's fire or wind or insects, there is going to be some kind of disturbance that affects your forest ecosystem. And this is maybe the biggest holdup with that landowner, is that they expect to go outside to their forest and see the same thing tomorrow that they did today. And that tomorrow could mean tomorrow, or it could mean 10 years from now. Yeah. The problem with that is we know that the forest is constantly changing. They might be small changes day to day, or over the next 5 to 10 years, it might look completely different, whether we touch it or not. So those disturbances are important. They're necessary for a forest ecosystem to exist. They're part of that ecosystem, and they're part of the successional process as a forest is constantly changing. And without those disturbances, I think you could make a pretty easy argument that your forest health is declining in that ecosystem. So because we're removing some trees, we're basically focusing a finite amount of resources on the trees that we're not removing. We're basically saying we have 10 trees maybe that we know are doing pretty well. They're in the right place. They're the right species. And so we need to remove all of the other stuff around them in order to support them. So we're not out there trying to make a buck. We're trying to pay likely several thousand dollars to somebody with some pretty expensive equipment to maintain. And in order to do that, we need to make a little bit of money off of that management operation so that we can at least break even. We don't have the money. We can't shell out 10,000 bucks this weekend so we can do a thinning. We're not rich enough. So we've got to target a few trees in that process that we are going to cut and make a little bit of money off of. We're not trying to get rich. We're really focused on forest health, maybe creating a more fire resilient forest, a forest that's more resilient to changing climate in the future. And that change part, again, to me, that is key. The landowner, the adjacent landowner, has got to understand that whether they're in California or in Missouri, it's not going to look the same, and it shouldn't. A forest is not, it's not going to be the same thing day in and day out.
For sure. I think that's great and wise, that expectation of change. Although it may not be drastic from day to day, it is going to change inevitably, whether you intercede or allow natural disturbances to intercede, that forest is going to change. I think that's definitely a valuable conversation. Go ahead, Adam. You're on that topic.
No, go ahead. I'm getting ready to ask a big question for him. So,
well, I was too. So I was going to ask, with that forestry management side of things, and kind of getting back into the term carbon sequestration, how does that impact the healthy forest, the management of a forest in carbon sequestration, age of trees? We're talking quality versus quantity. Can you kind of talk about that?
Sure. I mean, if we looked at a growth curve of a tree or a forest, it'd basically be typically kind of sigmoidal. It'll be shaped like an S, right? So at first you get a slow increase in basically carbon. Then all of a sudden you get this rapid exponential increase, and then eventually it tapers off. And that tapering off part, that's really important to bring up. If we're going to put everything into preservation, we want everything to be an old growth forest. That tapering off of growth and biomass production, basically we're growing leaves, branches, a tree trunk, that's eventually going to, that the positive growth is going to stop, and it's going to start to become negative. Essentially, the tree is going to start shedding branches. The top's going to break out. At that point, it's putting more carbon into the atmosphere than it's sequestering. We can call a forest anything from a carbon sink, where we're putting, we're able to sequester a lot of carbon. Anything from that to a carbon source, where it's falling apart at the rate that it's basically putting more carbon into the atmosphere. So that part early on, the sequestration rate is much faster. Of course, the bigger trees are going to sequester a lot more carbon because they have, you know, much bigger root systems. The tree bole is bigger. So somewhere in the middle there, we're sequestering at a pretty high rate. We're also sequestering a large amount of carbon. If we let that go, again, eventually it's going to taper off, and we're going to be emitting more carbon than we're sequestering. So we need to think about that management part. We need to think about, you know, if we're doing a selective cut in central Missouri with hardwoods, which trees should we target so we can keep that carbon balance positive? We're sequestering more than we're emitting, basically.
That's what my question, basically along the lines, my question was going to be, Matt. And Oklahoma State Extension did a post, I don't remember, it was a while ago, a couple of years even, I think, that was showing the way that grasslands store carbon versus the way forests store carbon, and that a lot of carbon that's stored, of course, in the roots, but a big part is in the trunk. So my question was going to be along the lines of, if you're, how would you, from a forest management standpoint, engage in carbon harvesting, and if that's possible?
Well, it depends. Yeah. And it depends, again, first on the species. Yep. So a good example with that in Oklahoma is Eastern red cedar versus loblolly pine. Eastern red cedar, we know there have been studies that have looked at this. We've got a lot of Eastern red cedar around the state. So why don't we just leave it all up? Of course, that'd be really unpopular, but let's say we left it up and it's sequestering carbon. Well, we know the rate at which it's doing that is not great. Now, if we plant loblolly pine in the eastern part of the state, it's going to sequester a lot more carbon. Mm-hmm. Something like Eastern red cedar is not the species we want to target for sequestration. So it depends on the tree species. Depends on the site too. We also want to make sure, again, age and size matter there. So, and site. So are we growing the right tree in the right place? Now, like you mentioned, harvesting more carbon, and really there's two parts there. I mean, basically we cut down our white oak. Let's say we make some wood products out of it. That is sequestered carbon in itself. That wood is carbon that's locked up in something that's going to stay there for a long time. Mm-hmm. If it had died and it's decaying on the forest floor, then that carbon sequestration is being lost. It's slowly, you know, coming back to the atmosphere again, whereas tied up in some sort of wood product, it's actually a sequestered piece of sequestered carbon. So, you know, depending on what kind of a carbon storage we're talking about, whether it's a wood product or a live standing tree.
Yeah.
We just have to target right age, species, size, location for our management for carbon.
So I'll give you an example. On my family farm, we did a logging operation or I guess not family farm, but the farm we purchased right next to the family farm. And a lot of the red oaks species, specifically the black oaks, were not looking very healthy. So we decided to go in and harvest these black oaks that were seemed to be deteriorating, and really nice logs. But as they were cut, and then as a few years went by, that root, they started stump sprouting back very, of course, they have a huge root system feeding little bitty root suckers. And just a couple of years there, some of them are over eight, 10 foot tall already. And you're just like, holy cow, those things are growing so fast. And it kind of begs the question for me, going, okay, if those logs, unfortunately, they were deteriorated so much that they probably weren't used for hardwood floors, but it was like, you know, if they were used for even railroad ties, they're not getting chopped up or burned up. And so railroad ties, and we're just laying there in the ground. And, but now we have this root system feeding new growth and probably starting to store carbon. Is that something, you know, to me, I looked at that going, boy, that looks very, renewable to me. And I feel like this is a message that we should be sharing more and more, is like, if we can create this system of harvesting, continuing root growth. Now it's not probably the case for all trees, obviously with pines, but how is that message? Do you see the movement of the forestry industry going in that direction with climate change and the discussion of environmental friendly practices?
Yeah. And I think it's more regional, depends on the product and the interest. So for example, out Northwest, a place like Seattle or definitely Vancouver in British Columbia, there's a huge emphasis on cross-laminated timber. So they have basically taken wood fibers, they're laying them at 90 degree angles across each other, and they're creating structural lumber that they can essentially replace concrete or steel. The framing of a building could be wood. Now,
I've read an article about this. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and if the whole frame of the building and all the siding is wood, I mean, that building is basically a giant block of carbon that's sequestered. It's not a source of carbon that's going back into the atmosphere. And that's, to me, you know, we cut something down, we're regrowing it again, and we took that sequestered carbon and we're using it somewhere else. You can't do that with steel, you can't do that with concrete. So there are places where that's becoming more of an emphasis. And I think architects are starting to understand that wood has some properties that steel and concrete does not. I mean, it flexes. So places out west that are earthquake prone, that's a huge plus. They can actually make it hydrophobic. It'll drive out fungi and rot. They can also impregnate it with a chemical or do like a torrefaction process. They can actually make it so it can't catch on fire. Huh. So some people have talked about, for example, World Trade Center in New York City. Of course, we can't make a CLT building that's that tall. Yep. But in that case, instead of the metal and the concrete melting and bending and twisting and cracking, if that was wood, then potentially you don't have that same structural collapse. Again, I'm not suggesting we make buildings that are 120 stories tall with a wood frame, but along those lines, if we've got like a 10 story tall building, it's possible to get to close to those heights now with wood. And like you're saying, it's sustainable, and we're growing more of it. We can't grow more steel, we can't grow more concrete, but we're also sequestering that wood in the actual building itself.
I think the conversation, like, conservation is the wise use of natural resources, right? And so that implies the usage of, and the wise use, it's coming back. It's now we've got forestry practices that are more sustainable. Hearing these things, it's a very positive direction. But again, we have to be mindful, no matter what perspective you're coming at it, environmentalist, hunter, conservationist, landowner, we need to be actively managing forests to have these benefits that we've talked about.
Yeah, and Matt, I think we talked about this a little while ago too, that we can have all these things together. You can have a managed forest where you're sequestering carbon and you're improving habitat for wildlife. You can also make money off some of the trees while you're going about that business. So to me, that's what we need to be focusing on in forest management, is we can have all of these things together, and we really should.
I think from what your guys are saying, it's got to be a very exciting time for you in this kind of shift, and everybody's more educated and more aware of what's going on. So the education and the research has got to be just, you know, very excited. I'm excited, sure. And I'm not even a forester.
Definitely exciting times. Yep. And I think forestry, just like any other science, is nuanced. That means it's complicated. That means we've always got more to learn, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's an exciting time for the landowner as well. I mean, this is solid information to be able to them to utilize it. Hey, we don't have to pick sides of fences here. Like, we can do it all. We can be diversified in our approach and accomplish X, 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 and X. And like make this impact that we're all trying to make positively on the land that you're stewarding, and kind of creating that legacy effect. So, I appreciate your time, and I know you've got to run and have some other meetings, but I think this is a very positive conversation. I think we'll kind of be inspiring to the audience.
I hope so. Glad to talk to you guys.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.